Well, it's now my pleasure to introduce formally to you Dr. Mortimer Feinberg, PhD. I'm not going to read to you all of his tremendous CV, which is on the back of your menus, but he is chairman of the BFS Psychological Associates Incorporated in New York and is one of the world's leading experts on business psychology. I know that he's going to present to us a very challenging observation now, and I know that some people have perhaps honed their eyes in on the second paragraph there, where we learn that he's written on many, many subjects as diverse as sex and romance in the office. So, what's to become of? Dr. Feinberg has interviewed very many famous people over lunch. He's been talking to us about a lot of that. At least four American presidents have shared platforms with him. I don't, therefore, think that even a Scouse audience is going to present any fears for him. He is known as a concise and a witty speaker, and I know that he certainly is that. He has given me, I'm very proud to receive from him, a book, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things. And I think after he's finished talking to us today, we'll certainly perhaps all know how to become a bit smarter in our businesses. There has been some recent press coverage of his current tour, in which he is quoted as saying that Britain will sort itself out when the present generation has died off. So, let's hear what Dr. Mortimer Feinberg has got to say to us today.
Thank you, Linda. That introduction is a lot better than I usually receive. Once I had to give a lecture at the University of Mexico, and I arrived a little late, and I looked around the bull ring, and I saw somebody all dressed up. I said, you're the matador, and he said, no. I said, you're the picador, and he said, no. I said, you're the bandolero, and he said, no. I said, what do you do around here? He said, I lift the gate up to let the bull through. So thank you, Linda, for that introduction. My job after lunch will be to lecture, and your job will be to listen. And if you finish before I do, raise your hands and I'll quit. Actually, Linda didn't give you my qualifications. They fundamentally are threefold. One, I have been a professor at the Baruch College of the City University of New York. None of you know probably where that is. It's in the middle of New York. It's the institution that trained Jonas Salk and Felix Frankfurter and Henry Kissinger. I don't want to brag, but I knew Henry before he had an accent. I checked his grades, found he got an A in every subject except he got a B in European history. So I wasn't confident what he was going to do when he was Secretary of State. Second, I have been involved with the tech group since almost its inception through the auspices of Sir Brian Wolfson and Mark Price of the LTech group, so I know something about your great thrusts. And third, I've been a father. I have two sons. And now I have grandchildren, and grandparents and grandchildren get along famously because they have a common enemy. Third, I'm an organizational psychologist. I work with companies on team building, organizational development, executive selection. Industrial psychology is much like the sex life of an elephant. It's practiced at very high levels amongst much noise and confusion. And so, out of this, I'd like to weave in some comments about what I've observed, and I hope that I won't create any new enemies in my comments. I'm reminded of King Arthur had all the knights of the round table surrounding him, and one knight came over and he said, where have thou been? He was all shaken apart, Lord Lochinvar, and he said, where have thou been? He said, I've been out raping, pillaging, destroying your enemies in the east. He said, I didn't know if I had any enemies in the East. He said, you got them now. So with that, I would like to give you some kind of historical perspective as I see it. I have been a long admirer of this great nation of the United Kingdom. I fought here in the Second World War. I saw the great courage of this great people. I have enjoyed every single visit here, and I do have some challenges and some problems with the British psyche. I think that, let me tell you first what I think are some of the challenges of the future. One, I think that you are a people that have greatness in you. You are people of your word. There is no nation in the world that can be trusted as much as a British gentleman or woman. I've observed this, you know, as Yogi Berra said, you can observe a lot by just watching. You have honesty. You speak English, which is the language of the future. May not speak it as well as I do, but you speak English. Third, you have an educated thrust. This whole thing that Mark Price and Sir Brian and Linda and all the people are doing in investment in people is a major international thrust. There's no other country in the world doing it. By the standards, by measuring yourself, by willing to be evaluated, by a constant evaluation. Those, I think, are your tremendous positives. Now, you might say, well, you know, my father would say, the sun will never set on the British Empire because God never trusted the British in the dark. So, having said that, I think there are some challenges. One, you are, because of your great positives, you are too polite a people. You just are lovely to be around. If you want to retire, there's no place better than in Britain. Everybody will be quiet. They'll help you. They'll cluck over you. They will step, you know, if you fall down in Paris, they'll step on you. If you fall down in New York, they'll step over you. If you fall down in Liverpool, they'll cluck over you and bring you tea. However, because of that, there is a lack of desire. There is some degree of, you know, you need some elbows and some movement and some anxiety and some tension and some willingness to have a great desire. This, you know, everything you do, you accept. You got a bad snowstorm in London. Well, you got the bad snow, but it's all right. You get bombed the hell out of you in London during the war, and it was okay. You survived that, and it was marvelous the way you did that. But on the same part of that is this feeling that there'll always be an England, that there'll always be. You go back in your history. You know, I was in just in this group here that doing the pharmaceuticals and the flu vaccine, and you know they've been here since the 1800s. And I go with Mark Price, and I go visit his great grandfather's grave. You know, we could never do that. My whole history has been obliterated. You know, and my parents said nothing but the hope that we would have an education. Back when I was born, my parents put an ad in the paper saying Max and Frieda Feinberg are relieved to announce the birth of their son, Dr. Mortimer Feinberg. So, you are very comfortable. You don't complain. You know, you get bad service in a hotel, nobody tells them. Or maybe Mark did. You are perfect. You know, you make an announcement that Linda's lights are out. But you don't complain as other coaches do. There was a survey done on British Airlines, and they asked people how many of them had problems on British Airlines. 90% of them had problems or some sort that they were complaining about. What percentage wrote in? By the way, I throw my students sugarless candy when they give me a right answer. It's sugarless because my bright students were getting diabetes. Can you give me a shot on what percentage you think complained to British Airlines after they would had a problem? Who said 2%? Who said 5%? Oh, okay, there's the first sugarless candy. It was almost right, 8%. Only 8% of the Brits complained.
Excuse me, don't like that candy.
Oh, all right. The Brits are also a bit of a smartass. You know what a smartass is? They sit on a keg of ice cream and tell you the flavor without looking down. American Airlines, people made up complaints. It never happened. They thought they might get a free pass or something out of American Airlines by complaining. The man Marshall Field, who started one of the great chains in the United States, said, "Those who come to flatter please me. Those who complain teach me how I may please others so that more will come. Only those that are displeased but do not complain, they refuse me permission to correct my errors and improve my service." Another thing, you're laid back. I mean, you have a marvelous city here in Liverpool. I said to this gentleman here who is in charge of something or other, everybody here in the head table's in charge of something. I mean, I'm the only one in charge of nothing. I was saying, you know, you have a great city here in Liverpool. I've been here before, and I went to the National Maritime Museum, and I saw where my relatives came over. I'm not Irish, in case you haven't noticed. You know, I don't know what the Irish believe in, but they're willing to die for it. But my relatives happened to come over through Liverpool Port. And it was marvelous to see that great museum, great memorability. It's beautifully done, marvelously presented. Do you know that I have no friends who have ever visited Liverpool? Never. How many times have I visited London? Maybe 10, 15 times. I mean, here you have this great opportunity, a great museum, a great city, the port city, where, you know, and I went to the cathedral here, and I saw the grave of the man who led the great forces of your navy against the Nazi horde. And so my feeling is that you need to wake up. I did say that maybe you're going to have to wait, because where there's death, there's hope. Maybe you're going to have to wait a generation for more restless executives to emerge. Maybe you're going to have to wait, but I hope not. I hope that what is being done here in Investors in People, what is being done here in a wake-up call. See, I don't particularly, in case you haven't noticed, I'm a great lover of the Germans. In fact, I told President Nixon that you shouldn't have used Germans like Ehrlichman and Haldeman to do the bugging. You should have Japanese. They're shorter, they're better electronically. Third, they would have confessed, and fourth, they would have committed Harry Carey. So I am not happy when I see the domination in the European community of the Germans, although I do believe you're going to have to, I had a long discussion on this with Margaret Thatcher, just to drop a name. I mean, I listened. In which she talked about the Anglo-American alliance, which I believe in strongly, that no people except the English-speaking nations have maintained democracy, have created a world in which human beings can live tolerably as much as the English-speaking nations have done. But I do understand that Europe has to be of the future. And I understand those challenges. I'm not like Lady Godiva's husband, who grabbed her and said, "Where the hell have you been? The horse has been back for an hour and a half." However, I do hope that Britain and this great United Kingdom will wake up. I think that the thrusts you're doing here, this luncheon, this Investors in People, these kinds of things, I think are necessary. Let me tell you what I think of the characteristics of successful executives and successful companies that I have observed. And it goes back to the 500 BC when Lin Chung, one of the great commanders of the Chinese world, said there are five virtues of a general. One, he must be wise. If he is, he's able to recognize changing circumstances and to act exponentially. Expediently. Sincere, his men will have no doubt of the certainty of rewards and punishments. If humane, he loves mankind and sympathizes with others and appreciates their toil. If courageous, he gains victory by seizing opportunity without hesitation. He's not sicklied over with the pale cast of thought like Hamlet. If strict, his troops are disciplined because they know that he will be swift with his punishments. Now, I have about 14 points of what I think companies in this country have to do, and I will give them to you rapidly. And if you want to have any more of my writings, I'd be glad. There are some handouts of all my Wall Street Journal articles as you leave here. I believe in writing. I believe that all I can do for the lecture is to lead you, as Cahill Gibran said, to the threshold of your own self-awareness. I read everything from National Geographic to Playboy magazine, primarily because I want to see colored pictures of places I will never visit. First, understand what you do best. Don't try to do what somebody else can do better. The people in the, was it that I visited this morning with the flu vaccine, just got the award, yeah. Evans, yes, Evans. Evans has a better vaccine. They say they have much less side effects. They do that best. They've increased significantly their share of market of the flu vaccine. Do best, do only what you do best. Don't try to be second or third in a market. I don't care if it's a small retail store or whether you're making a vaccine. Because if you know what you do best, you are less likely to make errors. Analyze early enough your product, your customer focus. What does your customer want from you? Do you have the demographics and the psychographic data to back it up? How do you respond to customer complaints? How fast do you respond? I did some study here with my work with the Kellogg Company here in England. I asked them to do an interesting study. I said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. When somebody complains about the not enough raisins in the raisin bran, give them immediately two boxes of raisin bran. Those who complain the same complaint at random, select those and don't give them within 2 days a response. Wait 2 weeks and then give them 10 boxes. Who felt better? The ones who got the immediate response to their complaints. You must not wait more than 1 day to return a phone call. You must, as soon as you get a customer complaint, and I've seen that in the LTEC group, post it. Post the complaint. Say, this is what our customers are saying about us. Don't be haughty. Don't think that you'll always have the customer. Today, in the world of information, everybody has to be evaluated more rapidly. This is what the computer revolution is doing. Well, I was in a group in outside of London. They are working on a little cart now, which will go through the aisles in a supermarket and will clock where the woman or the man stops, how long they stay there. They will clock on how fast the response of the sales clerk is to open up a new cash register. And also, if you don't pay as you go through, the cart will beep and have a siren on it so that you'll never get through that without having a siren response. That the computer world is going to mean faster responses, and you will not have time to survive unless you're able to respond rapidly. Customer focus, technology, distribution, quality. How do our customers rate the quality of our products? Are we the lowest cost producer in certain activities? People, how do we rate our people? How do they relate to their morale, their satisfaction? And the group, I'm sure here at the tech can provide you with other criteria. Then I did an analysis of companies that have succeeded over 50 years. In the States, we don't have companies like you do for 200 or 300 years. So I did a study on companies who have made it over 50 years. Here's what they have in common. One, they have big, audacious goals. They're committed to keep challenging their goals. They say, whatever we do right today, we have to make obsolete, which is a very tough problem to do. This is what we were talking about earlier, in which this gentleman was saying, they should have seen in Liverpool that the ports were going to be taken over by airplanes. But they were doing well enough, so they forgot about it. They let the world go by denial. You've got to say, what am I doing best today that will become obsolete tomorrow? What do I need to change today? And that is the role of you gentlemen in the CEO's position. Not the human resources people, although I have great admiration for human resources people. They are the glue of a company. But it's the CEO that's got to take the responsibility to say that I am responsible for changing what we do best today in order to prevent us from becoming obsolete in a rapidly changing world. Second, they have a cult-like culture. When you go into companies that succeed, you know, they sing songs. IBM, they said the fame of IBM spreads across the seven seas. With T.G. Watson, we lead throughout the world for peace and trade. Our banners are unfurled to him who brought us world acclaim. Ever the chorus of our voices rise, hail to his honored name. People need that. People need to be, life, my father would say, is too daily. When you get up in the morning, you got to fill what's empty what's filled, and scratch where it itches. We have to have a little drama in life, a little excitement. This hotel should greet people with music. They should have somebody at the door in an old English uniform. People need to have some fun, some excitement, a little difference in their lives. They create that with their people, the cult-like culture. Next, they try a lot of stuff and they see what works. They are not frozen to fear of failure. That's one of the things that the Brits have. They feel that failure is final. Failure is never final. You failed in something, try it again. Try something different. Failure is never final. I've interviewed a lot of young people here, friends of mine who are British and their children. Well, I don't know if I should try for Oxford. I don't know if I should try for... I don't know. I might fail. So what? That's the greatness of frontier psychology. You fail. So what? You go on. You pick yourself up. Failure. When I interviewed Nixon, he said, no failure is final unless you ratify it. He said, I never ratified my failure. He said, I never endorsed it. You try things. Next, homegrown management. Companies that succeed in the long run have managers that have been part of their culture. They don't constantly go looking around to the outside to think that somehow there's an epiphany. I just mentioned that so you know I know the words on the right side of the Bible as well as the left side of the Bible. They're not expecting an epiphany. They say, I am going to make the average schmo better because he's working for me. He's going to be a little, this woman or man will be a little bit better because he's working with me. He's working as part of my team. There are no perfect people out there. All of us are broken vessels. Which brings me to the characteristics of successful executives. One, it is not a matter of IQ. I studied this for 35 years. It is not a matter of intelligence. The world of business is run by average students. You can have 110, 120 IQ and be a very effective executive. In fact, I don't have a chart here because they ran out of lights or something. IQ and drive. High IQ, high drive. Make him a staff officer. He's too smart. Like Carter. Carter was brilliant, but he's a terrible leader. He always looked like when he's smiling at hemorrhoids. Every president shoots himself in the foot. The trouble with Jimmy was he reloaded so fast. There are exceptions, high IQ, high drive. Margaret Thatcher. I think she has high IQ and high drive. Question is, would she have been a better advisor than a leader? That I don't know. High IQ, low drive? Best kind of line officer. They don't want to do everything themselves. Low IQ, low drive, good junior line officer. Low IQ, high drive, they'll kill you. My father would say, son, sinners can change, but stupid is forever. So you want to make certain that you screen out that. Second, just plain sheer energy is the characteristic of good executives. They can get up after a fight. They can fight the next morning. They have enormous energy. They have enormous ability to move and to recover from failure, to fight one more round. It's a great little poem here that I picked up this morning in the cathedral. little words of wisdom in the gift shop there. Marvelous little gift shop. And it said, you know, fight one more round. When it seems worse is the time when you got to pick yourself up. My father would say, a successful man picks himself up at the count of nine on the ninth round in a fight when he can't get on his feet in front of a massive audience. You got to be able to fact to say that no failure is final. I have enormous stamina. Not necessarily high IQ. What are they high on? What we have now calling social intelligence. Regan, in case you haven't noticed, was not very bright. You know, compared to Thatcher, he was a pygmy. And there was a woman with a marvelous brain. And so was Bush. Bush was Phi Beta Kappa, etc. Reagan was not bright, but he had marvelous social intelligence. Reagan had a great smile. You know, every night looked like prom night. You know, he was always waving from the horse and hello, goodbye, and you know, and no problems, we'll work it out, we're a great nation. You know, and we were falling apart. But he kept us together. He said, we'll beat the damn Russians. You know, and he had this great ability to have social intelligence, a social IQ. Now, what do we define as social IQ? One, they have the ability to delay gratification. You can teach this to your children. Freud pointed out there are three aspects of the personality. You know who Freud was? I got a candy here she didn't like. Well, let me make it fast. The id, the ego, and the superego. I want it now, and I must have it now. Ego is our delay gratification. The superego, it's bad to do it, it's wrong to do it, etc. We have raised, unfortunately, a generation that are very pleasure-oriented to the present moment. You have to, good executives delay gratification. You take children, you put them in a marshmallow test. What's the marshmallow test? Take 15 marshmallows. Say to the child, 4 years old, you can have one marshmallow now, but if you wait 15 minutes, I'll give you five. You teach them to delay gratification. You don't need to get that raise now. We'll put it in a profit sharing. You have a marvelous program here, which I just learned about. You have profit sharing, which is tax deductible up to 4,000 pounds. That's a delay of gratification. You delay it until the retirement if you need to. They have a delay of gratification. Second, they have the ability to smooth over relationships. They are not confronters. They say, let's all three if we can get a win-win out of this. It's not that I've got to win and you've got to lose. We can both win. This is what Reagan tried to do with Thatcher. You try to create a win-win environment. Not that I am good and you are bad, or I got to win and you got to lose. Try to do a win-win. Third, you control your... Are you leaving already? I saw one guy go. I said, where are you going? I said, I learned all I could use. They have a characteristic of controlling anger. Aristotle put it well when he said, A person who's a great leader knows when to get angry, at whom, for the right reasons, at the right time, with the right amount of anger. The ability to control your anger is one of the most important characteristics. How much time do I have now that they've... Can I go another 10 minutes or so? Okay. Let me give you the characteristics then. A very fast summary. A loser says, let's find out. A winner says, let's find out. A loser says, nobody knows. When a winner makes a mistake, he said, I was wrong. When a loser makes a mistake, he said, it wasn't my fault. A winner credits his good luck for winning, even though it wasn't luck. A loser blames his bad luck for losing, even though it wasn't bad luck. A winner works harder than a loser, but still has more time. A loser is always too busy to do what's necessary. A winner makes commitments. A loser makes promises. A winner says, I'm good, but not as good as I ought to be. A loser says, I'm not as bad as a lot of other people. One of the discussions we had at the luncheon table here, I guess I like the way the Brits do this, you know, call it the high table. Very nice, very impressive, high table. I loved when I, you know, the captain of the Titanic, you know what his last words were? You know, they're all sinking. Everybody's going down. The ship is going down. They hit the damn iceberg. He didn't say, you know, I just stopped to pick up a little ice. What was his last words? Any of you know what his last words were? Marvel exhibit in London of the Titanic. The last words were, be British. They're all sinking. That's what my father said. Never go on a British ship. Go on an Italian or German or French ship. They don't believe in all this nonsense about women and children first. But that, of course, is one of your greatnesses, the ability of them to man the ships as they go down. We talked about energy. I want to just give you 10 minutes of a very fast summary of what it is psychologically to maintain energy. I call it the caddy. C-A-D-D-Y. I've analyzed executives, as I said, and men and women for 40 years. And here are the characteristics I have found of those who can maintain high levels of energy with social intelligence. One, they are good communicators. They have the ability to let people know where they stand and what they want of them. They do not send them confused messages. You know, they go out of a meeting and say, what did he say? I don't understand the thing. What does he want from us or her? They are very clear. The message is sound bites. This is what I expect. This is what I want. This is what will help all of us. Second, they control their anger. They don't get angry over small things. They don't lose their cool because somebody trips them or they're delayed or something like that. They learn to control their anger. They say they don't put up resistance in vain. Nothing I can do about it. I'm not going to worry about that one. I'm going to worry about the big things. I'm not going to die on a small cross. D is for delight. They maintain, and this is the most important characteristic, a sense of humor. The ability to laugh at oneself. Life is a tragedy for those who feel and a comedy for those who think. I try to collect these things wherever I can. This is British school children's answers to church school questions. Noah's wife was called Joan of Arc. The fifth command, this is actual. The fifth commandment is on humor, their father and mother. Lot's wife was a pillar of salt by day and a hell of a ball of fire at night. When Mary heard she was going to be the mother of Jesus, she went out and sang the Magna Carta. Salome was the woman who danced naked in front of Herod's. Holy acrimony is another name for marriage. It is sometimes difficult to hear what is being said in church because the agnostics are so terrible. I love Irma Birnbach, who said that I jog just so I can hear heavy breathing again. Laughter breaks the ice. Reagan, when he was shot and the hush nation was worrying we're going to have another Kennedy assassination, up in a time to sow and a time to reap and a time to laugh and a time to cry. But for Lord's sake, find as many chances as you can to laugh. One, what it does is it's an internal massage. You don't have to go here to the health club and get a massage. You know, you lose all muscle tension when you laugh. You ever see, you know, when you were children, you don't laugh that way anymore. You laughed so much, you fell down on the floor. You lost all muscle control. It's the most marvelous. It's God's smack. It's God's gift to us. It's the surge of the epinephrines. It is like cocaine. It gives you that great feeling, my God, it's not so terrible. I can manage it. I can cope. It gives you a chance to reestablish yourself. And most important, remember to laugh at yourself. Take time to laugh. It gives you a perspective. Practice humor. I try to call my friends whenever I hear a good story. They say, hey, you know, first thing, you know. Because my father taught me, laugh and the world laughs with you. Cry and you cry alone. 90% of people don't care about your problems, and 10% are glad you have problems. In case you haven't noticed. That's the one thing he was writing down there. Do this for delight. The second D of caddy. The reason why I use caddy is because I play a little golf, and I was unfortunately going to run into this little golf shop here, but I didn't have time because I play a little golf. I have a great short game, except it's off the tee. I said to Jack Nicklaus, I said, you know, I played with him one time in a tournament. I said, how am I going to get longer off the tee? He said, I'll tell you what I want you to do, swing. And I swung, and he said, here's what I want you to do, Feinberg. I want you to hit the ball and run back. I'm in more bunkers than Eva Braun. And I once played at the Doral, and I was very angry at my caddy. I lost my cool. Didn't have good social intelligence. And I said to the caddy, you're absolutely the worst caddy I've ever seen. He said, not possible. I said, why not? He said, it would be too much of a coincidence. So laugh. Next is dreams. We spend 27 years of our life in sleep. Everyone dreams. You need to dream. You need to get that REM cycle going. You wake up in the morning, you're depressed, you had a bad dream. You don't remember it. Everybody has dreams. You don't remember them. Some of you dream in black and white. Some of you dream in technicolor. Dreams are ways to protect your body. Dreams are, as Shakespeare said, the easing off of a coil of trouble. Now, there are a lot of things that interfere with your dreams. What are they? One, alcohol. Deadly before going to sleep. Two, sleeping pills. Deadly before going to sleep. Never take sleeping pills unless there is an emergency, a death in the family, or some terrible crisis. Don't take sleeping pills. It interferes. Okay. Exercise before going to sleep. Sex, unless it's very satisfying, can disturb the sleep. If you travel at night, I try to avoid this. I couldn't because I had to be in a commitment here on Tuesday, and I had to be in a temple for the high holy days of the Jewish religion, and so I had to fly at night. I never fly at night because it knocks your whole rhythm out. Now, we once had a pilot, and we asked him, when's the last time you had sexual contact? He flew over the pond from New York to Birmingham and Manchester, and he said, 1945. My interviewer practically fell off the chair. He said, that's a long time ago. No, he said, it's only 2400 now. Then we go into sex, which is another way to release tension and increase your... You don't have to be have sex, though, to have high energy. Priests, nuns, others can do it, but it is a great energy release. And I don't have time. If you invite me back, I can talk about that. So I can see the rest of Liverpool. All I can say is fundamentally, let me just... I don't do this to humor you, just to try to teach. That's what my job as a teacher, a professor. Is there a fundamental difference between men and women? And men never have understood that. It's only through the work of Masters and Johnson. What's a fundamental difference? Very rapidly, it is that women have great trouble because of the genetic background, because of the bearer of children, to have sex casually. To them, it's a kind of, sure there are differences, but kind of commitment. And it's psychologically very important that the man makes the woman feel that she is being cherished. and important and necessary and appropriate that the sex. See, but men, sex is an itch. You know, it's got to be done fast and get over with. You know, the definition of Irish foreplay, brace yourself, Bridget. Polish foreplay, are you awake, Bertha? Jewish foreplay, 5.5 hours of begging. Finally, because we've been held to, I wish I had more time with you. You have been marvelous. It's a marvelous city, Liverpool. And the why is for you. I want you to take a careful look at yourself. By reading, I don't mean by psychotherapy, but by a clear analysis of where you stand, how committed you are to being the best you can be. I don't want you to be different. Nobody wants you to be different. Are you the best you can be? Are you doing the best job you can do for your family, for yourself? I ask people to find out your Harry window. It's on the left hand. It's how do I see myself now? The second pane of glass is how do other people see me? What's my ideal self-image and why is there a gap? And what do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want people to say about you at your eulogy? Why is there a gap between how you see yourself now and how other people see you, and what's your ideal self-image? I'd like to end with two quotes, one from Douglas MacArthur. I worked under MacArthur, way under. I was a clerk. And MacArthur wrote a poem to his son in the dark days of the Philippines when he did not know when he would return. He said, "Oh Lord, build me a son who'll be strong enough to know when he's very weak. And I pray, O Lord, lead him not in the path of ease and comfort, but under the stress and spur of difficulty and challenge. Here let him learn to stand up in the storm. Here let him learn a little compassion for those who fail. And I pray, O Lord, teach him a sense of humor so that he may take things seriously, yet never himself seriously. And I pray, O Lord, teach him the humility of true wisdom and the greatness of true strength. And then I, his father, will dare to whisper that I have not lived in vain." Or James Michener in his book, Fires of Spring, when he said, "This is the journey every man or woman must make to find themselves. Once they have this, they know what they can be counted upon to do. The limits of their courage, the extent of their dedication, their ability to surrender part of their inner life to some man or woman, their love of beauty, their unpostured goals, the position from which they will no longer retreat. Then that man or woman has a mansion which they can occupy with dignity and with respect all the years of their lives." This is a marvelous city. I, as you know, a great admirer of this great nation. I'd like to wish you something that the students wished me once in London. I wish you health. I wish you wealth in Liverpool without shame attached. I wish you inner beauty, and I wish you always to be young among old friends. I hope this is not a disappointment. Thank you. The best tribute was the standing ovation by three beautiful women.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we were going to have a question time, but because of the delays in the program, I feel you'll want to be getting back to business. Dr. Feinberg has said that he will be around. He did. Dr. Feinberg said he will be around, and he'll be very, very happy to talk to anybody who wants to stay and chat with him further. It's very, very, very hard indeed, isn't it, to follow that. He said it was his job to lecture. I think we give him a very good job appraisal review. In fact, an excellent job appraisal review. Thank you very much indeed. That was unique and challenging and really, really interesting. I've learnt a few things. I just picked a few things out of that. He tells us not to be so gracious as a nation. He tells us to get our elbows out. He tells us to complain. He tells us to be like tigers. And it's those tigers on the Pacific Rim that are challenging us now. He tells us to be risk-taking. And of course, if you're going to be risk-taking, you've got to have the strength and the support of the people around you. Interesting, to grow our own managers, to develop your people, grow your own managers from within. But the most important thing, of course, that win-win that we're all looking for everybody in our organizations, and to delight our customers. Successful organizations need a cult-like culture. Successful regions need cults. Merseyside is a pool of talent. You've not had a free lunch today. I hope that you have had your thinking challenged, and I hope you go away with dreams and with delight. You've certainly had a laugh. And I hope you go away with vision. We very much hope that you will make a commitment to be an organization that believes in and invests in your people, and will work with the tech to become recognized nationally as such. So once again, on your behalf, can I thank Dr. Mortimer Feinberg for an absolutely tremendous, not a lecture, he took us into his hearts and his humor, and I hope that you all enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you very much, Dr. Feinberg.
Comment is that I worked under John Fitzgerald Kennedy. I was assistant secretary in his cabinet, and we didn't know, and I asked someone at Kennedy's funeral, what it was like to work with him on a daily basis, and I know he had a glandular problem, and I know he had a bunch of other sexual activities, but he was still great to work with, and the man said, we never knew we were in Camelot until it was all over. So thank you for Camelot.
One of Dr. Feinberg's last quotes was about journeying and finding ourselves. I wish you all a very safe journey. I hope you find your way beyond the cones on the M57. Good afternoon, and have a very nice evening and weekend. Bye-bye.